Hello, and welcome to Films That Time Forgot, a podcast looking at overlooked films from the 1980s all the way to the early 2010s. I'm Adam Thornton, your host, and joining me today is Nick Bartlett.
Hello.
Now, Nick, now you've been on the podcast before, but for any new listeners coming in, could you tell them what you do?
I write about films for a few different outlets, formerly Slash Film, but now I write for The People's Movies and Critical Popcorn and Film Hounds.
Now, today's film we're going to be covering is an interesting one. It's the 1985 Jackie Chan action film, The Protector, but it's not a Hong Kong action film. It's instead an American film. It's the second attempt by Jackie to break into Hollywood in the 80s after The Big Brawl, which is directed by Enter the Dragon's Robert Klaus all the way back in 1980. Now, Nick, had you heard of The Protector before?
No, I'd never heard of it before. I've seen I'm kind of familiar with Jackie Chan's films. I haven't seen a lot of them, but I've seen like Wheels on Meals and Lucky Stars and Miracles, which I really loved. But yeah, I'm not that familiar with his stuff, especially the US stuff. So this was like a new experience for me.
Yeah, it was directed by this guy called James Glickenhouse, who made more kind of standard Hollywood kind of 80s action films like The Exterminator, which is like a more violent version of Death Wish. And he clashed a lot with Jackie during the making of this film, particularly with the fight choreography, because Jackie kept complaining that he was given little chance to film the fight scenes. He was given very little time to film them. And he didn't like Glickenhouse telling him to act more like a Western action hero like Clint Eastwood, which kind of comes across in like, I mean, when we get into it, but it comes across particularly in like the opening scenes of the film. It really feels like Jackie's trying to be pushed in more of a Western style direction than what
Yeah.
he was used to, even more so than his previous film, The Big Brawl.
Yeah, it's weird because I was watching it with my wife, and it at the start it comes up with a James Glickenhouse film, and I was like, well, it's probably gonna not really be a James Glickenhouse film, is it? It's gonna be a Jackie Chan film. No, knowing the films that I've seen before, very much like he's the one who's like in charge of all the choreography and stuff, or at least you know he it's that sort of the vibe. But like as it went on, I was like, oh no, it kind of is a James Glickenhouse. I don't really know what a James Glickenhouse film is, but it doesn't feel like a Jackie Chan film. So like I guess it's accurate.
Yeah, and Jackie was so unhappy with the way the final cut had turned out that Glickenhouse had filmed that he went back and reshot scenes in Hong Kong to make the film into more of a Jackie Chan film. So adding in more two acrobatic fight scenes with more comedy, and editing up the other fight scenes to make them more fast paced and there with more varied camera angles. And he also added in a new subplot as well, involving a Hong Kong singer, a famous Hong Kong singer playing another female lead. But despite this, the film still did kind of average business in Hong Kong compared with his other films, and barely got a release at all in America. It, in fact, grossed less than $1 million compared with The Big Brawl, that had made at least about 20 million in the States. And I guess Warner Brothers maybe weren't confident in the kind of film that Jackie had made with James Glickenhouse, because it is very, although it is in many ways similar to 80s action films, it is in other ways quite different.
It's got a very strange vibe, like right from the start. Like when you see that initial, there's that initial like robbery on the truck, and I was watching it. I was like, is this some sort of like Mad Max aesthetic that's going on? That everyone's dressed in like punks with like you know vests and stuff, and then it turns into like I don't know, it's sort of very cliched like buddy cop thing, and then his partner dies, and then that seems like unrelated to the rest of the film. It's very sort of. It doesn't feel tonally, it's sort of all over the place, and it's only like the second half where it starts to sort of you get an idea of who the bad guy is and what they're doing and stuff like that. But yeah, it's a very disjointed, like, tonally is very disjointed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the Mad Max stuff is weird because they're basically like dwarfs and like punk rockers and dwarfs dressed up as pirates trying to steal stuff from a van. But we don't get anything like this later on in the film. It comes from, again, as you said, it seems to come from almost like a Mad Max dystopia type setting because the rest of the film tries to be more realistic. And the first part of the film set in New York is definitely trying to go for more of a gritty 80s action vibe, similar to, again, The Exterminator and the Charles Bronson Death Wish films.
Yeah.
But yeah, that gang, one, it doesn't totally fit in with the rest of the film. And also, we don't get to see Jackie take them on.
No, it's just completely dropped. It's like completely dropped in from another film. And yeah, I think it that we can go into the plot in a minute, I guess. But like, I like there are bits in it I like, but like as a whole, it's just it's very messy, and like you don't really get a sense of you don't really get a sense of him of like sort of. Any sort of camaraderie between the characters or any sort of chemistry. So it's just like, okay, we're doing this now, and now we're doing this, and now we're doing this. It's a very odd film.
Yeah, I mean, we do kind of get a bit with Danny Aiello later on, but it's very abbreviated. But we'll come on to that because there's also kind of like really awkward English language dialogue between Jackie and his cop buddy.
Oh
Because
yeah.
Jackie's work, and it establishes that Jackie's been in the country for 10 years, which I guess explains his ropey English. But I think it kind of explains why in Jackie's later Hong Kong films, no, Hollywood films, they either establish him as an outsider or they establish his partner first and then introduce Jackie and make it clear that English isn't his strong point because the
Oh, yeah.
dialogue exchanges between him and his partner are kind of really clunky.
Yeah, it's very sort of stilted. And it's like it feels very much like the that McBain clip from
Oh,
the Simpsons
yeah.
with Scurry. It's like okay, with even right away, you're like, okay, this guy isn't long for this world. But yeah. I think yeah, it feels so incongruous to hear Jackie Chan swear as well.
Oh,
Like
yeah, because he does that like quite a few times in the film, and it's just this really doesn't fit your image at all. Not only in like in a Western film, but even in Hong Kong films, Jackie was very careful to keep a sort of clean cut image. And here they're trying to position him as this sort of Dirty Harry, Cobra-esque kind of cop who doesn't play by the rules.
yeah, and he doesn't, but he sort of does play by the rules as it goes on. I don't think doesn't deviate that much from the rules, does he?
No, he doesn't. So they can't even. You're wondering if maybe as the production moved to Hong Kong, Jackie just took over more and just was like, right, you're on my territory now. We're going to do things more my way. And that's what caused the conflict between him and Glickenhaus.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. He looks very cool in it. I like he's got a very good jacket early on.
Yeah, he's got this very good, like, it's like a brown, like, bomber jacket, isn't it?
It's just a mess. I read that I read that he got a lot of stick in Hong Kong for the massage parlor scene as well. There's nudity in that, and he was like, apparently that he got
Yeah, that's yeah.
backlash
There's
for that.
a lot of gratuitous nudity in this film, which very much feels like Glickenhaus sort of Glickenhaus very much having an influence there. But the next scene we see Jackie and his partner in a bar, where they get ambushed by a gang who hold the place up, and Jackie's partner gets brutally shot. Again, with oh, again, the violence in this film, it's what you'd expect in an 80s action film, but not in a Jackie Chan film, because he gets ambushed in a toilet by one of the gang members, brutally shoots him, and then goes out of the bar, and then goes out into the bar. But instead of immediately trying to stop his partner from being shot, he kind of lets his partner get shot and then spends his time sort of doing pre-John Woo sort of dives across across the bar room firing at the other gang members. And whilst it does look cool, and I think even for an 80s action film, this looks a lot more acrobatic than you would get, say, from the likes of Stallone or Chuck Norris. It still does feel weird seeing Jackie blowing people away with a gun.
Yeah, I mean it turns into a sort of like, yeah, John Woo like or Paul Verhoeven like amounts of like gore when the guys are getting just when the partners just getting massacred with a machine gun. It's like you don't expect to see that in a Jackie Chan film. And also I like that Mike Starr's there. Did you recognize
Oh
him?
yeah, he's the big bloke, isn't he? Hugh confronts
Yeah.
Jackie in the toilet.
No, he's one of the other, I think he's the one in the hat, but yeah,
Oh
he's there,
right.
the guy who was, he's in Ed Wood and Goodfellas and loads of other stuff, and it's like there's a few instances in that film where like proper character actors pop up in really minor parts. Like I don't know if you noticed like the truck that gets like hijacked at the start and then has no bearing on the rest of the plot at all. The guy who drives it is what's it,
Trey
Trey Smith,
Wilson.
Trey Wilson, yeah, from Raising
Oh
Arizona.
yeah, it's
Doesn't
funny. I
recognize him
didn't
at all.
It's funny. I didn't recognize him at all. I have a terrible face for like American character actors, but I can do it. But I can recognize Hong Kong character actors for some
Yeah.
reason.
Well, I recognized Roy Chow from later on,
Yeah,
but yeah, that was about.
he's also really underused in this. But we'll come on to him. Now
But yeah,
he, now
that
Ja,
I hope that
yeah,
sorry,
sorry.
the bit in the diner, like it's so over the top, and then but
Yeah.
then it leads into that almost like it's almost like it's trying to like emulate the Bond films and how you know there's always a pre-credits. This isn't
Yeah.
pre-credit. That is always like a pre-credit set piece. It's almost like that's what they're going for here with like the whole the boat race thing and like
Yeah.
the and it doesn't really come off because there's no like then it's because once it's over it's like right on with the plot but it's like well what's that got to do with this sort of thing is
Well, I mean, to be fair, it does kind of set up Jackie's character being a renegade cop, and it is a well-filmed chase scene that Glickenhaus has set up. Like Jackie's in a speedboat, so he's chasing the one gang member that's got away and is in a boat. And there's a bit where he dangles from a helicopter to escape from the speedboat that's crashing into the bad guy's other boat. I mean, that's well filmed, and in any other like action film, 80s action film, it would stand out. But I think because, again, I'm so used to seeing Jackie doing even better stunts at this period of time, during this period of time, even before, with stuff like Wheels and Meals, and later on he'd one up this with Armor of God and even the beginning of Police Story. You just sort of think this is really good for like 80s for an 80s Western action film, but it's not enough for a Jackie Chan film.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the stunts and sort of action sequences they look all right. They're just it is just a bit generic. And like I think I read Police Story was sort of made in response as a response to this film really as a way to sort of him to gain some credibility again in Hong Kong because it was like that
Yeah.
this performed so badly. But I think I read somewhere I can't remember where I read it. Somebody talking about quoting Jackie Chan about how like. When Bruce Lee died, Jackie Chan was sort of the next, was sort of positioned as the next Bruce Lee. But instead of sort of taking on those sort of roles, he sort of created a new persona for himself. So it was like rather than being the next Bruce Lee, he was the first Jackie Chan sort of thing. And I think in that, he works a lot better in that sort of framework where it's like he's given the chance to sort of do his own thing. But once you put him in someone else's, like
Yeah.
something in an existing framework like this, where it's like a story, like kind of a story, but like, you know, he doesn't fit as well, and he doesn't really get a chance to shine as much. Like he's very good because it's Jackie Chan, you know, and
Yeah.
he's always going to be good. But like, you can sense all the way through he's sort of right, he's uncomfortable, and he's not quite as dynamic as he would be in his own sort of in his own thing, you
Yeah,
know.
because in the scene after the kind of speedboat action scene where he's being shouted at by his boss, again, that's something that you can imagine happening in, say, a Dirty Harry film.
Yeah,
You can see it happening in a Charles Bronson film. But he just comes across as just very kind of awkward. Jackie Chan, he doesn't seem to know how to stand or how to react to the actor who's yelling at him, and he just sticks out like a sore thumb in this kind of like rundown New York police station. And then the next scene, Jackie's now been demoted to working security at a fashion show, and this is where he meets his partner, played by the great Danny Aiello. One of the few good things about the film.
Oh, okay.
All right, you don't agree.
I like Danny Aiello a lot. I love Do the Right Thing. He's really good in like Leon, but I think he's miscast in this film. I think he's fine. His delivery's fine. I feel so bad for him when he's paired up with Jackie Chan, basically. I think they're okay together, but in all the sort of action sequences, he's just sort of awkwardly doing his best, I guess.
Like throwing the occasional punch, and sometimes they let him shoot at people with a machine gun.
Yeah,
That's it.
there's the whole scene in the massage parlor where it's like Jackie Chan is they're both in towels, and Jackie Chan's doing all the fighting, and Daniello just runs is just running to his locker to get a gun, and it's like this is not a what this is a very one-sided partnership.
But to be fair though, Danny Aiello, no offense to the guy, but he's not really in the same shape as Owen Wilson and Chris Tucker. You can't expect him to be
No.
throwing kicks left, right, and centre.
That's what I mean. That's why I think he's miscast. I don't think like he's fine in his sort of roles that he normally plays, but this is sort of not he's not out of his depth because in the scenes where it's just the two of them like wisecracking to each other like that in that introduction scene in the fashion part he's very good, and there's bits where they're talking to like the their sort of what do you call it like their
Boss.
the but no but the boss in but in China where they're talking to their sort of new friends and stuff he's actually a lot more convincing than the other characters, but in the action sequences he seems a bit silly at times.
It is very one-sided, which they do. I think Glickenhaus tries to correct that later on by giving him some machine gun stuff to do, but he's not really cut out for action stuff as Danny Aiello. But in saying that, I do think he has more convincing chemistry with Jackie than some of Jackie's other Western actors that he's been paired up with, like Jennifer Love Hewitt and like Jennifer Love
Maybe, right.
Hewitt and Steve Coogan.
Yeah, I mean, yes, probably. But then you could easily just say, but it's no Chris Tucker or Owen Wilson type thing, you know? Like, I think,
Well, I
like.
mean, I don't know. I mean, I think chemistry wise, he's on the same level. Like, and
Okay.
the few amounts of bonding that they that the screenplay gives him and Jackie, they work well. But the problem is that the screenplay doesn't give them enough bonding moments because, again, they're trying to establish Jackie Chan as this kind of serious action hero, the serious Western action guy who doesn't really have enough. Where there isn't that kind of space for banter, because this took place kind of before Lethal Weapon kind of popularized the whole buddy cop thing.
Yeah, fair enough. You're right. It's like there's not really, it's not really that kind of script, is it? And I guess like within the confines of the script, they both do okay, and they do have a sort of chemistry. I don't know. I'm trying to agree with you,
But
but I just don't.
but to be fair though, it is like chalk and cheese when it comes to the action. And the lack of which we'll come on to, because after the organizer of this fashion show, a woman called Laura Shapiro, is kidnapped, and Jackie has a nas had a nasty run into with Laura's bodyguard. You've then got armed men sort of breaking in through the ceiling, through the skylight in the ceiling, and breaking into to where the fashion show's being held. And you'd expect Jackie to break out the martial arts in order to try and rescue Laura. But there's no action. Instead, him and Danny just put their hands up, and then it cuts to their boss shouting at them for letting the kidnappers get away.
Yeah, rightly so. What were they doing? But that bit reminded me. I think it's one of the Armor of God films starts the same way. It might be in a gallery or something where there's loads of bad guys sort of break in and start either machine gunning people or kidnapping people. I can't remember which one, but yeah, I think in that one Jackie Chan isn't there and then he gets brought in after, which makes more sense than he him you wouldn't don't expect Jackie Chan to sort of watch that sort of thing happen.
But it's like, why wouldn't they give Jackie a chance to show off his martial arts? I mean, because I mean they do that. I mean, it's not like they didn't know in Hollywood how to structure a martial arts film before, because in the Chuck Norris films of the same era, you would have had Chuck break out his much more limited karate. You would have somebody like Shokasugi in the Canon Ninja films, who was the closest you got to a non-Western lead in an action film back in those days in Hollywood. You would have had him showing off his martial arts, but here Glickenhaus just says Jackie do nothing.
I know it's a very strange decision to make. I mean, I guess it's a sensible decision to make if they're so outgunned, but at the same time, that's not what you want. You don't want sensible decisions in a Jackie Chan film, do you? You want.
Yeah, it feels almost like it's a Western film written for any action star in Hollywood at the time, and they just decided to quickly slot in Jackie at the last minute and change the second half of the film to Hong Kong.
Yeah. That's what it sounds like. That's what it feels like. I recognize their boss from something, but I couldn't work out what. But yeah, no, never mind. That's a yeah.
So Jackie's boss learns that the bodyguard that Jackie bumped into at the party made suspicious phone calls to a mob boss in, or a drug dealer rather, in Hong Kong called Ko, who Jackie sort of has some history with, or certainly knows is a feared figure in Hong Kong, because it turns out that Ko was had a business deal with Laura, the girl who was kidnapped's father. So they decide that Laura must be held in Hong Kong, which means that the rest of the film then takes place in Hong Kong. So you don't really, it's kind of weird that in Jackie's breakout, what's supposed to be Jackie's second attempt to break out into Hollywood, he spends most of the film in Hong Kong.
Yeah, yep, I hadn't thought of that. It's a very strange decision to make. There's a lot of strange decisions in this film. But yeah.
Because you'd think they'd go for more like a fish out of water thing, like they do in The Big Brawl, where he's an immigrant that's recently arrived into New York, and you thought, oh, maybe they'd play a bit more on that, like they do in the Rush Hour films, where he's a Chinese detective in LA. But they don't really do that at all. Instead they try and make it so that he fits into his New York environment. They try and play it as much as possible, and then they quickly move him to Hong Kong. I guess because they maybe in an earlier draft they realised that it just wasn't going to work with him as a Hong Kong cop, as a New York cop. I don't know.
Yeah, or maybe they decided that if they're going to do a fish out of water sort of story, and take a fish out of water angle, maybe it'd be better if Danny Aiello was the fish out of water. You know, he's not where he doesn't know what's going on, and like it's like yeah, where he's where it's that Jackie Chan's the one who's like more aware, and Danny Aiello's the one who's sort of wandering around not knowing what sort of about cultural things and stuff. Like, because I mean, yeah, it's almost like the Chris Tucker part in Rush Hour, isn't it?
But
When he's sort of, I think Rush Hour.
they don't really take much advantage of Danny Aiello being out of place, because I think he says at one point, "Oh, when I was in Vietnam, I used to come to Hong Kong on my way back to America." So it's not like he stands out that much in Hong Kong, and he seems more at home there. And they don't really play up him being sort of fazed by Chinese culture.
No, they don't do it well. I'm just saying maybe that was the idea. I don't know. Yeah, I'm saying this a lot. It's a very odd film. There's lots of scenes where that are like full of like potential, and you think, oh, this is going to be interesting, and then they sort of divert away from it at the last minute, or they go back to the most sort of conventional sort of approach to it, which I find it very strange.
Yeah, because there's also potential for them to clash with the British chief of superintendent in Hong Kong who they first meet. But apart from a twist at the end, that doesn't really seem to come up at all. There's not really much in the way of a rivalry between Jackie and Danny and this British superintendent.
Yeah, he doesn't get much screen time, does he, that guy? So when the twist reveal happens, you're like, oh, okay. It doesn't really have much impact because we don't really get a sense of who of him as a person. He's just a sort of authority. Like, he's mainly just an exposition dump, isn't he, explaining who Ko is.
Yeah, and we kind of go abruptly from him talking to Jackie and Danny to them checking out the massage parlor where the bodyguard was calling. And now this is the one part of the film that I think does kind of work in terms of feeling more like a Jackie Chan film and feeling more like a precursor to his later Hollywood stuff. Because in fact, you get a similar scene in Rush Hour 2,
Yes.
where him and Chris go to a similar massage parlor. And you do get some nice bits of comedy and bonding between him and Danny, where they're getting a manicure and they're fooling around in like a spa. But it's very brief.
Yeah, it's a bit more lighthearted at the start of it, isn't it? And even when the action starts and it's revealed that there's like a, the workers there, the masseuses are actually like assassins. I thought it's a fun kind of like suspense, isn't it? It's not like, oh my God, they're gonna die. It's like, oh,
No.
this is fun. This is a fun little action set piece. And
Yeah, because it starts off with Danny joking with one of them who's completely full frontal, completely nude. And I think that was, yeah, I could see why the Hong Kong audiences didn't like that and maybe where Glickenhaus's influence came in.
that was the scene that got the backlash from the from Jackie's fans, I think, and also the inexplicably naked women at the end as well. But
Yeah,
yeah.
that's also completely reshot at the end by Jackie completely reshot that, by the way. They're fully clothed in
Oh,
the Hong
yeah,
Kong version.
that's the choice I think I agree with, because I mean, I guess that you could have a reason for them all being naked at the end, but it's very odd.
Yeah,
It's a very weird sequence when they're all climbing up the ladder.
it's completely gratuitous. The masseuse girls are revealed to be assassins working for Ko, and we do get some nice action with Jackie fighting off the girls. And again, it's very well choreographed again for like 80s Hollywood. I mean, you get some nice kind of spin kicks, you get great use of Jackie fending off one of the girls with a massive lamp. But it's over with too quickly. And it's also like about half an hour into the film, and this is the first proper martial arts action we've got from Jackie Chan in a Jackie Chan film, which is ridiculous. But yeah, Danny Aiello's inclusion in the scene is very awkward because they don't seem to know what to do with him.
I just feel so bad for Danny. I mean, Danny Aiello probably feels great about it, but like, it's just like, I don't know, like, you got Jackie Chan in his absolute prime, and you've got poor Danny Aiello just sort of running around in a towel, and like, he doesn't really contribute much. It doesn't make his character look cool because he's just running off to get a gun from his locker. So he can't really contribute much in the way of fighting.
Yeah, and it has to keep cutting away awkwardly from Jackie, doing spin kicks to Danny rushing to his locker and trying to pull his gun out. It's very jarring, but the action just kind of spill over into the rest of the massage parlor, and we get a nice moment where Jackie's sort of running across the spa, and he keeps burning his feet
Yes, I
on.
like that.
But again, it goes by too quickly, and you're wondering if this was longer, but Glickenhaus cut it because for a Western action hero to do that, it would be too goofy and it would undermine them.
Maybe it's different. It's like the whole film's like a constant tug of war between like James Glickenhaus seemingly wanting to do like a quite a formal, not quite a conventional like pop thriller, and Jackie Chan trying to make it a bit more light-hearted, or at least Jackie Chan not quite having his persona nailed down yet. And it's like, moments like that are like, you can see, like, you can see where it, like, where the where he's going, you know. You can see like stuff, you can see like stuff from his like wheels, not from his more sort of light-hearted stuff coming through. But then it's like, you get the sense James Glickenhouse is trying to stamp that out almost, to go, no, this is a serious and it's like, it's a very, yeah, because I like that the bit where he jumps in the swimming pool and he just immediately jumps out, because it's like I really like that bit. But yeah, you're right, it's so fleeting. It's gone, and then we're back into the no normal fighting.
I mean, most of the action in the film is like standard martial arts that you would expect from any Western Hong Kong action film at the time, not just Jackie Chan's films. But it is definitely a step above what Chuck Norris was doing at the time and what you were getting in the canon ninja films, because you didn't really have a lot in terms of American martial arts films at the time in the 80s. Once Enter the Dragon had come out, you got a brief kind of spurt of martial arts but films, but then it kind of died down to just Chuck Norris and that was it.
Yeah, and I do. You get. I know I'm criticizing the film a lot. I think the action choreography is very good, and the fight scenes are very good. It's just there's that sense. It's just that butting of heads of two different kind of styles, I think, that doesn't mesh well.
So after Jackie and Danny overpower the thugs at the massage parlor, they then go to this contact of Jackie's at the harbour, who when they ask him for information on Ko's whereabouts, he stalls until more of Ko's men jump aboard the ship. And again, there's another fight scene breaks out, again very well choreographed. But again, as in the massage parlor scene, it's kind of awkwardly balanced because you've got Jackie doing what he does best, although very abbreviated. And then you've got Danny Aiello just awkwardly punching one or two guys off the boat and holding one of them up with a gun.
Yeah, again, it's a little bit. I mean, at least this time Danny Aiello has his gun at the start of the sequence. But yeah, it's very much the same sort of thing, isn't it? And it's like, I don't know, sort of hoping for a bit more at this point, like maybe a bit more detail rather than just same sort of fight scene again.
And again, it's over with very quickly. But what Glickenhaus does spend a lot of time on, strangely enough, is this like kind of acrobatic chase scene where Jackie's trying to chase after the massage parlor owner. He's followed them, and he sort of jumps from boat to boat because the contact is on a boat in the middle of the harbour, and he's jumping from boat to boat to get to the massage parlor owner's boat. And Glickenhaus spends a lot of time filming Jackie doing this. And whilst the acrobatics are impressive, you've got Jackie kind of shimmering down pole, shimmying down poles, using a motorbike to jump from one sort of part of the harbour to onto a boat. It's not really. Would an American audience in the 1980s find this kind of chase scene exciting?
No, it doesn't have the same sort of what do you call it, like momentum as you might expect in a more sort of in a better action film. It's like that. I like the bit where he's jumping across all the boats, but it doesn't. I don't know. It's not as exciting as it should be.
Yeah, because there's a lot of slow-mo as well that kind of slows it down even more. And it's what the one hand, it's not something you would see in an American action film, that kind of acrobatics and that kind of chase scene. But on the other hand, it's not really the best use of Jackie Chan's abilities.
No.
And also, is it really that fun to watch?
No.
Because even in a Hong Kong film, that kind of chase scene would be brief, it would be quick, it would be faster paced, and you would have, again, some fighting intercut with it. Like you would have Jackie fighting some of the massage parlor guys on the boat, on some of the boats, throwing them off. I mean,
Yeah.
even Robert Klaus, who filmed Jackie's earlier attempt to break into Hollywood, would have sort of had more action there. And you're wondering if James Glickenhouse just wasn't confident in filming the martial arts scenes at all, so he decided just keep them to a minimum.
Yeah, I mean, this the thing with Jackie Chan's other films is he is the fact that they've he's got such a like he's got such a what's he's got like dedicated like stunt team, hasn't he? Who works with them? Who worked with them all his Hong Kong films? So he's sort of like, where are they? Like you want to see more of that, more sort of fighting and all of that sort of thing. And I feel in this one, it's too, it's it feels too dry.
Yeah, he's very much. Well, I think he's running into a similar problem that he had with his earlier with the Big Brawl, is that in that he's working a lot with like Western stunt performers, and that earlier film had him trying to do similar action scenes to his Hong Kong films at the time. But the problem was that the Western martial artists, or stunt performers rather, couldn't move fast enough, so he had to shoot all the action scenes for that film at half speed. So, and if you watch that earlier film, the fight scenes in that are quite kind of awkward and slow. So I'm wondering with this one, he decided, because he didn't have his stunt team, that it would be better just to not film that many fight scenes at all, to keep it to a minimum, rather than to get them to fight his way, which they couldn't really do. So, after failing to catch up with the massage parlor owner, Jackie then ends up back in the contact's boat, where the contact tells him and Danny to come back tomorrow, and he'll have more information on where Laura is being held. Now, it's at this point in the film where you kind of start to go off into where the Hong Kong cut starts to kind of diverge, because, again, as you said, Jackie shot different scenes for the Hong Kong version to fit in with his audience there. And there's this added subplot where he goes to a gym without Danny Aiello, where there's a girl he knows there who'll lead him to Ko. And he gets into a fight scene there with two guys, which in the gym, which again is well filmed by his standards. He uses the his environment to good measure. He uses the gym equipment to knock out the two guys, and the way they react is very sort of comedic. It's very slapsticky, fitting in with, again, his style of action, and what you would get in his later films like Police Story. But the only problem is that in the Hong Kong cut of the film, it sits alongside all the gritty stuff that Glickenhouse filmed, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I can imagine. I only watched the US version, but yes, that sounds about right. I know the final fight. I've seen the way the final fight is cut, and it sounds similar to that.
Yeah, it's a lot more fast-paced, the final fight. It's a lot more evenly balanced in terms of the action, which we'll come on to. But all the Hong Kong cut in general of The Protector doesn't really make the film better, as it does make it different. Like, there's this whole subplot with this girl where she basically takes the place of Jackie's contact on the boat. And we later find out that the massage parlor owner was related to the girl. He's the girl's uncle, and Jackie then helps him to escape Hong Kong. And that's really it. And there's also another fight scene where Jackie's contact on the boat dies. We actually see him getting killed on screen this time.
Oh, that might have been good to have in the American cut, mightn't it?
Yeah, in the American cut, he just turns up dead, but here we actually see him trying to fight off the guys, Ko's men that come to kill him. And it's a well-filmed fight scene, and again, it would add a bit more action into the film. But I can because it involves the girl that Jackie meets at the gym, it kind of would come out of nowhere. And apart from that action scene and the fight scene in the gym, the rest of the added scenes are more or less redundant. They just seem to be there just so that Jackie could, I guess, claim some sort of co-director credit, and Yeah, the whole bit with the massage parlor owner wouldn't really work in an American film.
I can see that. I do think it's strange how he turns up dead though, because I think like you never get a sense of Ko as a villain. Like he doesn't do
No.
anything really villainous until the very end, and it's like, and Roy Chow is great. I think he's very good at, he's got a very great sort of villainous presence when he turns up, but like the character is so thinly written. It's like, yeah, it's like he does everything from off screen, and I think having showing him actually, even if he's not there himself, it at least showing his him doing something, being proactive and, you know, murdering someone would raise the stakes a little bit and make you think take him a bit more seriously as a villain.
Yeah, I mean, he's shown in like one other extra scene in the Hong Kong film with the bodyguard, where he's shown picking up the bodyguard from the airport and he's shown punishing the massage parlor owner by having the bodyguard beat him up. So I guess that would be a
Yeah.
good scene to have in, actually. So I think maybe unbalanced, the Hong Kong version is better. But yeah, it is strange how even that scene, which wouldn't be out of place in the Glickenhaus version, Glickenhaus forgot to add, but Jackie did.
Yeah, it's odd.
So we then go, Jackie and Danny go back to the hotel room where Ko's men have been in there and left him a bribe, basically a suitcase full of money and two plane tickets out of Hong Kong. And Ko then rings up to talk to Jackie. And watching this film just makes me realise Roy Chow, it's a shame he's underused in this film because he's got a great villain voice.
He's brilliant. I mean, I've not seen apparently like A Touch of Zen is a film a big like Hong Kong film he was in. I mainly know him from Temple of Doom.
Yeah, he plays Lao Che in the opening Hong Kong scene, or
Yeah.
Shanghai scene where Indy's in the club. He's the
Yeah.
main bad guy. And
He gets one of my favorite like line deliveries, I think, in any film where where he's holding the antidote. And he's like, and Indiana Jones is like, "What, the antidote to what?" And he goes, "The poison you've just drunk." Is like, it's a very good like dry delivery, and it's always like stuck in my head. So like seeing him in this, I was like, "I know this guy," and I was like, "Oh, it's Lao Che." So that was nice.
but he's so underused.
Yeah,
So,
it's to the point. Yeah, to the point where having him at the end, I was like. It seems because he's introduced, I can kind of see where they might have been going with him as a sort of like, as a villain, like someone who doesn't really get his hat, doesn't worry himself with like the nitty gritty of his job. He just like lets the other people deal with it because he doesn't seem like a very hands-on bad guy. But
no.
then at the end, he seems to have some sort of a grudge against Jackie Chan because he doesn't just get away like he could. He has to sort of come back. But like, so yeah, it's a very, it's again, it's something that's a bit confused, I think, because it's like, either he's an overt villain or he's someone who's just like about the bottom line and just wants to make money. And it's like there's not really it's very much at odds. His presence in the film is very much at odds with how he turns up at the end of the film. Does that make
Yeah,
sense? Like,
no, it definitely does. It's almost like they figured, oh, wait, we need to actually have more of a climax here, but we don't really, I don't really want to handle any martial arts stuff. So let's just have Roy Chow be suddenly a lot more threatening than he was earlier on in the film, where he's more passive.
yeah, because it when he first, there's a lot of him sitting behind the desk, and I'm making a lot of like Bond comparisons here. I don't think it is consciously a Bond, meant to be like a Bond film, but like it reminded me of the bad guy in one of the main criticisms of the bad guy in like The Spy Who Loved Me is that he's just someone who sits behind a desk pushing
Yeah.
buttons. He doesn't actually do that much, and he's just and then I feel like the same about Roy Chow with this, like he's just mainly seated, mainly behind a desk, and just sort of talking rather than doing anything overtly villainous, and then
Yeah,
until the end.
and it doesn't really help that there's not really, apart from the bodyguard at the end, there's no real villain that really poses a physical threat to Jackie, because he's mostly just mowing through random henchmen when he's doing martial arts. So there's not really a major physical threat that he can come up against.
There is the guy, I can't remember his name. There's the actual martial art, the actual other fighter in the film. What's his name? Who's like the main bodyguard?
Oh yeah,
And
Benny, he is called Bill Wallace. He
yes,
was
Wallace.
interestingly enough John Belushi's bodyguard when he died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was meant to be getting John Belushi in shape, but then Belushi overdosed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I liked him. I thought he was a good foil for for both of them, because he's like for Danny Aiello and for Jackie Chan. And I like there's that moment. Well, is it him that shoots Danny? Well, we'll get to that. But like, I feel like he had a good sort of presence, and I felt like it was a shame that he wasn't in there for the big final bit. He gets a good
Yeah.
the fight is great, but then obviously he's out of the film, and then you're just left with Roy Chow sort of quite generic henchman after that.
Who isn't very physically imposing.
No, but I think
Yeah.
the guy, what's his name? Sorry, Bill Wallace.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got a good like menace. He's very menacing. He's got a good sort of presence in the film, I think. He's just sort of he again like all the villains in this, he's sort of underused.
Yeah, it's yeah, for some reason they don't really make much use of him at all. So after the threat from Ko over the phone, Jackie and Danny are ambushed once again at the hotel. And once again, this mainly uses guns. Like you've got Danny Aiello shooting a henchman off the roof, which again features a very good kind of stuntman stunt where the stunt guy falls and hits the car. And you've then got Jackie chasing down the other henchman who tries to flee in his car, but Jackie then shoots him when he's in the car, which is feels like a precursor to Police Story, where I don't know if you've seen Police Story, but there's this bit where Jackie's in the middle of the road, and there's a bunch of henchmen in a bus that's coming towards him, and Jackie then sort of lowers his gun and points the gun at the bus, but then at the last minute the bus stops and the henchmen fly out and hit the road right next to him. It was
Yeah,
ripped off in Tango and Cash.
I've seen the Police Story, but I've seen that before, and it's great. And
Yeah.
it's
Yeah.
that's amazing. I'm just so, yeah, I got that sense as well. I was watching this. I was like, okay, I can see where Police Story got that from.
So
Like,
you're
yeah.
wondering if Jackie maybe saw what he was doing in The Protector and thought, nah, I can do this like 10 times better.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Because a lot of the Police Story is like The Protector, but 10 times better.
Yes. Well, I think
And
yeah, I think again, it's like I think he made it's a I think it's consciously like that. I think he sort of was like, well, how can I make sort of correct my profile, my persona, while still doing something a bit like this, and sort of that's where Police Story maybe came from, or maybe where it originated from, and then took flight.
yeah. So what happens is that Jackie and Danny go to confront Ko and chuck his bribe in his face, and then they go to the contact which they who they found who they find is dead in a burnt out boat. He's been killed off screen.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
I wish we'd seen that what happened there, because it would have been a good
Yeah.
in this moment. Maybe could have given a bit of depth to like if it was the chief bodyguard that did it, that would have been up the stakes for the final fight.
Yeah.
If he was present, it would have made him more of a villain. But instead, it's just like, yeah, it's weird, and it also it's jarring that it comes right after they've met him, well, after they've met Ko. Because it's like, oh, did he do that? We just saw him,
Yeah,
but
I think they got his he got some of his men to do it because they say he's got
yeah.
influence all over Hong Kong.
Yeah, I got that he didn't do it. He didn't literally do it himself. But like, it's also a bit jarring that it's like, I don't know. The editing is a bit sort of choppy.
Yeah, I mean it's an impressive image though with the dead contact because he's like strung up and he's got like spears rammed through him. I mean it
Yeah.
looks visually impressive, but again, we don't really again compared with the Hong Kong version, which is less visually impressive of how he dies, but at least we get to see more action.
Yeah. You're right. It's a nasty image, and again, it's like at odds with like Jackie Chan's sort of clean as a whistle look.
Yeah. It's very jarring to see this in a Jackie Chan film. But what's even weirder is the next scene, we've got Jackie and the contact's daughter going to visit a fortune teller to find out where Laura Shapiro is. And it's weird because you don't get this kind of mysticism, one, in a modern day Jackie Chan action film, even in Hong Kong. And you don't normally get this in a Western film. It feels a bit Orientalist. Like, they threw it in because the closest thing you had to this kind of East Asian action in the West were the ninja films, which relied on a lot of mysticism. And I guess that it felt like, oh, we need to throw in some Eastern mysticism in here. How can we do this? And I guess Jackie kept shutting down all their other ideas. So they just sort of said, oh, let's have him visit a fortune teller.
Yeah, it feels incongruous with the rest of the film a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the fortune teller doesn't give much advice other than to say that the bodyguards come to Hong Kong to make peace between Laura's dad, who's a New York gangster, and Ko, who's obviously a big drug dealer, and it's to make peace over some drug deal that they're going to do. But that's something you could get from any contact. You don't really need a fortune teller to tell you that.
No, maybe it was a way to sort of try and give the film a bit more personality and make it a bit more, make it stand out. It's like, oh, this, yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
So yeah, basically, Laura, the fortune teller also reveals that Laura's going to be returned to the bodyguard as part of this agreement between the two gangsters. And it's sort of random that it's this fortune teller character that tells Jackie this and not another contact.
Yeah, it's a very strange decision. Yeah.
I'm just trying to find the place. So yeah, so what happens is that Danny Aiello and Jackie track the bodyguard to and Co's operation to this load of shipping containers, and Jackie, Danny, and this other guy who worked for the contact, this Western, I think he's a US Marine, helps them, and he provides Jackie and Danny with this massive minigun slash rocket launcher.
Yeah, I did like that. I was like, when he was like, I've got just the thing, and he sort of opened up that compartment, I was like, is this just going to be like, you know, like Men in Black, where they just have all the guns just there?
Yeah.
Is this going to turn into that? And I was like, and then he started pulling out these like cases of stuff. And I was like, okay, cool. It's not that cartoonish. And then no, he just turns it around, and it is literally like got like a grenade launcher type thing. This didn't really look like a real gun, like all this other stuff. And I'm like, okay, cool. It is a cartoon. but
Which
yeah.
does kind of clash with the more gritty tone the film's going for, but then again, you got that with a lot of 80s action films like Death Wish, so it's not a
Yeah.
big surprise, and it also gives Danny something to do later on.
Yeah, and also, but also, I think at this point in the film, like that's the least of the film's problems is this tone clash. But yeah, he doesn't really get that much to do, does he? Because he gets a nice introduction when they're meeting the contact, and then I think he's there when they raid the drugs plant, but then he sort of disappears, or if he is there in the background.
Yeah, he's not a well fleshed out character because he's American, and you'd like to think there'd be a bit more background in how does he know the contact and him sort of, I don't know, having more dialogue with Danny Aiello and Jackie Chan. But yeah, I think he's just there just as a third wheel to make it more plausible that Danny and Jackie can take on all of Ko's men. It is shipping container
Yeah.
operation. I do like the action scene where they're actually breaking into Ko's drug operation, though, the way they're like coming in through the air vents.
Yeah, it's a nice bit of like, what's the word? Like the actual sort of spy work almost, like not just running in all guns blazing, which is sort of Jackie Chan style. But like it's like that, you can get out a bit.
A nice bit of acrobatics when Jackie's sort of making his way down the vent shaft.
Yeah, that reminded me a bit of Wheels on Meals, when they're trying to get trying to, when he's climbing up the building with that one, is it that one log that he's using, and he just keeps
Yeah.
like picking the next bit. I thought it reminded me a little bit of that.
But again, there's no comedy involved because it's Glickenhaus. And what's also very Glickenhaus is we get to see Ko's drug operation, and the women that are sorting out the cocaine are all completely naked. You see everything, breasts, the vagina, everything.
Yes, it's very weird. It's like, and it's almost like It's almost like it's absurdist the way it's done, with them all just sort of walking in single file and then climbing up the ladder like one at a time. It's a very weird visual. Like, I guess you can kind of understand it because, like, I guess they don't want them stealing any drugs. Is that the thing, do you
Yeah, I
think?
think that's meant to be the rationale.
But, like, it's never addressed. No one ever really talks about it. They're just there. And then they leave when the shooting starts. It's like, okay. I mean, it's a strange choice. I like them cutting open is it a melon
Yeah.
and hiding the drugs inside it, then gluing it back together. It's like very, very sophisticated technique they've got there.
Yeah, I was gonna say I'm very surprised that gets past any customs.
Yeah, that seems to be. This melon seems to be glued together. It's like,
And it's like, how's Co meant to be like the number one drug baron in Hong Kong with that kind of operation?
it's like it's so bizarre. They've got this whole operation going on, and it seems to be solely devoted to cutting open melons and then gluing them back together
And it
again.
all takes place in like a shipping container as well. It's like, how are you fitting it all into these like
Yeah.
free shipping containers?
Yeah, so the detail's not great, but the actual set piece that follows, the action set piece, I quite liked. With all the shootout and the henchmen turning up and then waiting at the bottom of the ladder. I thought that was quite a sinister moment. Like, yeah,
Yeah.
but yeah, then you have to then the naked women run away. It's like,
Yeah,
okay,
it's almost like one step forward, two steps back with Glickenhaus.
yeah. It's like this, oh, it's getting interesting. Oh, what's happening here? But yeah, I agree.
We also get some nice moments with Danny actually doing getting in with some action, shooting a lot of Co's henchmen with a machine gun, and he's actually, I mean, he's good in these scenes where he doesn't have to use his fists. He's good at using a gun.
Yeah, I do like Danny Aiello a lot, and I think in scenes like this is a lot more convincing. Yeah, and when he got shot, when he gets shot by the bad guy, it was very much like, oh my God, is he dead?
Yeah. There's also a similar moment earlier on with Jackie where he gets shot, and they play it for suspense quite well, where you're like, oh, was he shot? And then now he's wearing a bulletproof vest. But they do drag it out quite well.
Yes, no, I remember that bit, but I also I did think at this point in the film, Jackie Chan is definitely isn't dead, but at this later point in the film, I thought Danny Aiello might actually be dead, and that might
Yeah.
be a good, motivator for revenge and stuff. But yeah, I know.
Jackie and the other US military guy blow up Co's drug lab and have to drive off without Danny. So he's now in the bad guy's hands. He's now in Co's hands, rather than we know his name. And then Jackie gets Laura into the hands of the British superintendent, whilst he agrees to meet Co at a shipping container lair the next day to do a trade. So Danny for Laura. Now this is I always found this kind of weird though, because it seems to me like the climax is a bit slow paced and it's split up into three parts. So we've got the opening bit with Jackie and Danny infiltrating Co's drug lab and rescuing Laura. Then we've got this next bit where Jackie has to save Danny and Laura again, because it turns out that the British superintendent was working for Co, in a twist that comes completely out of nowhere, only because I guess in the 80s they needed to have a British bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, it only comes out of nowhere because we've got no idea of who this guy is, apart from the one scene, one exposition dump we've got so far. It's like if there had been a bit more characterization, it could have been a bit of a shock. Or if they'd been like, if he'd been established as like, I don't know. Someone on Jackie's side, that would have helped, but it doesn't really seem that way. He seems like a plot device more than anything.
So then we've got that section, but then we've got the third section, which is then Jackie having to chase down Co, which goes on for a lot longer than it should. And it seems to me that like the only reason why that was prolonged was because Glickenhaus realized, oh no, we haven't got enough action in the film.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean that, and that is the most. What's it when suspension of disbelief? I could not suspend my disbelief to that point where he's in the helicopter and he's not just flying away.
Yeah, it's like, why don't you just get away at this point?
Yeah, but anyway, but the final the fight scene in the warehouse, I did enjoy. I thought that was very really well done.
I liked it, but I felt that the US version was kind of awkwardly staged in comparison to Jackie Chan's other films, because even his Western films, like, there's not a lot of editing. It's shot mainly in wide shots, so it makes the action a lot slower. There's quite a few angles where you can see the punches and the kicks aren't quite connecting. And it's also a bit sort of, it's a bit, I thought it was a bit lopsided in that the first part of the fight scene is just the bodyguard beating up on Jackie quite easily, with Jackie missing out on plenty of opportunities to get hits in. And then all of a sudden, Jackie turns it around. What I did like, though, was is that obviously the fighting's at a much higher standard that you would get in Hollywood action films of the time, such as a Chuck Norris film. You've got better use of punches and kicks. You've also got a good use of the environment. Like, you've got Jackie using plant pots to defend himself against the bodyguard, and you've got the nice moment where Jackie knocks out the bodyguard with the wheel, which, although again, that's a bit slow paced. But I don't think, is that part in the Hong Kong version?
So I need to it's difficult because I watched, so I've only watched, this is the only bit of the two versions I've watched where I've seen the fight scenes both of them, but I'm trying to just distinguish in my head which one was which. I think the Hong Kong version is a lot cleaner in the way it's shot. It's a lot cleaner, it's a lot faster. And it's got that sort of Jackie Chan vibe where it's not quite as comic as he would be later on, but there is that sort of comic edge. He's got his hands in both of the pots at one point, and I don't think that's in the US version. It's almost funny again. And it's got that kind of editing where it's not, he cuts on the just before the punch, so you can, it's the thing with your brain can't quite register when you actually see it connect. You have to cut away before it connects for you to sort of feel like the impact of it. So it's that one's done a lot more like that. The US one, I think, is edited a bit more sort of formally, like how you'd normally expect like a film to be edited. And as such, it is a lot more slow paced. But it does feel a bit, for me, it feels a little bit more cinematic, maybe. I don't know. And in terms of like the overall tone of the film, I think it fits a bit better. In isolation, I prefer the Hong Kong cut a lot, the Hong Kong version more, because it's a lot cleaner as a sequence. But I also, in both versions, I do like the bit with the chainsaw. I think that's a really sort of, it's not nasty, but it's like, oh God, he's taking it up a level.
Yeah, because right at the end, after Jackie's fought off the other, where Jackie's knocked out the bodyguard with a wheel, you think that's it for the bodyguard, but then after Jackie's fought his way up to the top of the warehouse where Danny Aiello is being held, again, very good fight choreography, much better than, again, up to Jackie Chan's usual standard, and frees Danny Aiello, comes back down to the bottom of the warehouse. The bodyguard then ambushes him with a chainsaw, which I quite like, but again, it's over with quite quickly. Whereas I feel like in a Jackie Chan film and in another Hong Kong action film at the time, you would get much more of the fight scene with that. You would get, say, the other opponent, Jackie or another Hong Kong star action star would use another weapon and duel, and you'd have sort of like a duel against the chainsaw, which would be more interesting. Instead, you've got Jackie ducking the chainsaw, and eventually getting the bodyguard to ram the chainsaw into like an electric outlet and electrocuting himself.
Yeah, and that seems more on brand with Jackie Chan than, hip Jackie Chan actually killing the guy.
Yeah,
It
I
seems
did.
like that would be the alternative in this film, is that he just.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get what you're saying about it being over with quite quick, but I suppose the argument would be that we've just seen a big fight between the two of them. You don't want to redo that all again. So this is just a little sort of capper on the sequence, is having him pop up again.
Yeah, I
But
guess so. And I think also it fits in more with Western action conventions. And had this similar scene happened in again a Chuck Norris film or another 80s action film of the era, even like the canon ninja films, like American Ninja, I would be happy with it. But it just falls short of being a satisfying Jackie Chan action scene. And I guess for a Jackie Chan fan like myself, I'm thinking, oh, I could do a bit more with that.
yeah, and I guess you've got the sort of structure, the sort of structure of Jackie Chan films, and in something like Wheels on Meals, it's going to build to this point where he's
Yeah.
going up best fighter. Like, it's Benny, is it Benny
Yeah.
Urquidez?
Yeah.
Yeah, like in that you got that, which is like the gold standard of fight scenes. But like, so it's sort of similar to that. Anything's going to fall short of that, and I think this one in particular doesn't quite reach those heights. But you can kind of see what they're going for.
Yeah. So after that, Coven initially he actually tries to face Jackie head on. Why he does this, I don't know. But he sees what happened with his bodyguard.
There's a very conveniently positioned wrench that he picks up at one point, and then it's like, oh, we're not going to use that.
Yeah, I think Roy Chow versus Jackie Chan would be very one-sided.
Yeah.
So he runs off to his helicopter, and we then get this weird action scene, which feels like it would be in one of Jackie's Hong Kong films, but like one of his earlier Hong Kong films, it wouldn't be in any Western film at all,
No.
where Jackie ends up fighting Ko's another one of Ko's bodyguards, a Chinese bodyguard this time, as Ko's getting away in a helicopter, and they end up on a girder that's being lifted up on the ground by a crane. Danny Aiello also uses his rocket launcher at one point to blow up, I think, a gunman on top of the
Sorry.
crane.
Yeah, I think that on the fact they're fighting on the girder thing, that is full of, again, it's another scene that's like full of potential, because I could sort of see, it's sort of clumsily filmed, but I could see what they're trying to do. Like, every time he moves, that he knocks all those boxes off, and it gives you a real
Yeah.
sense of just how high they're getting into the air, into the being lifted. But it's I don't know, it's one of those ones where if it was sort of played a bit more light-hearted, like later Jackie
Yeah.
Chan, you could see it being a standout sequence. But in this sequence, it doesn't, he's not gonna fall off it.
And also, it's not really in keeping with the kind of gritty tone of the climax, having this comedic. Because it's almost like the scene where, like, it's almost like the bodyguard's throwing boxes at Jackie, trying to throw him off the girder, and Jackie's ducking them. And it's
Yeah.
like that would work in a Hong Kong. In Jackie's other Hong Kong films at the time, which were more comedic, that would work as a comedic sort of like almost video game type sequence because it's like live action Donkey Kong.
Yeah, and you get and like there's moments where it's like you get the sense that he's Jackie Chan's sort of, he's edging closer and closer to the edge of the girder, and it's like a bit like, oh God, what's gonna happen? But then also, it's a very anonymous bad guy he's up against. I don't think we've seen him before this
No.
scene. So it's like up against Jackie Chan. It's like, well, this is only gonna end one way.
Yeah, it's not really been built up. It's almost like they realised at the end, oh, we need to have another action scene here. Jackie, can you quickly film something with this guy who have thrown you in here just to fight? And Jackie's come up with this on the spot. And this is clearly Jackie's influence here. The problem is that one, it sticks out from the rest of the film. And two, whilst it's unique, I mean, you wouldn't get Chuck Norris doing anything like this.
No, well, I think it's more to sort of set up what Cho what sorry what Ko's doing in that time, is that he's getting in position with his Uzi, because otherwise it's like it doesn't make any sense. He'd have left. I think the idea of, he's there, he's up on this raised thing, and Ko's got his Uzi, and he's like, oh, I could just take care of this now. It's the only reason why he'd be sticking around, because otherwise it's like so silly that he's just waiting in his helicopter.
Yeah, that's kind of action movie. But to be fair, though, you could argue that is action movie logic. But I think this whole stuff with the crates and the girder, I mean, Jackie eventually does knock off the other guy, surprise, but I don't know if Western audiences would want to see an action scene like that. I
don't know
Western
what.
audiences at the time, would they? I don't know if they'd react well to an action scene like that.
I don't know. I mean, it seemed interesting to me to like take it, have a scene like that, where it, have a set setting where it's like moving and everything, and I don't know. The setting wasn't the problem. It was just the sort of the execution is what let it down, I think, a bit. And the fact that he's up against someone who is just a very, very much a thoroughly bad guy. There's no tension in that bit. I think it's just an excuse to get him up to the where the crane is.
Yeah. The stuff where he's going on to the crane, again, it's impressive. We see Jackie using his acrobatics to climb up to the top of the crane, which, again, you wouldn't get with any other 80s action film at the time, so I guess that's the appeal. But, and then when he gets onto the crane, he drops this weight onto Ko's helicopter, blowing him up.
Yeah, very conveniently positioned just underneath.
Yes. Very conveniently positioned. I mean, the explosion is good, though, when it goes off. I mean, the explosions in this film are good.
It's very good. Roy Chow's really good. I just wish there was that moment that you'd in any other sort of maybe in a West, in more Western action films, you'd get that moment where of realization on like Ko's face. It's like, oh no, I'm screwed. But instead, you don't get that. You just get a wide shot of him blowing up. But also,
Yeah.
did you notice when he's holding the Uzi, he's got like paint on his hands?
Oh, really? Has he? I didn't notice that.
There might be a technical reason. It might be oil from the prop gun he's holding, or it might be that they just painted it that day and the paint was rubbing off on his hands.
I think there's a lot of signs in this film of a low budget. Like we didn't mention earlier, but Ko's drug lab setup looks very cheap.
Yeah, a lot of it is very cheap. So I mean, the big rocket launcher that Danny Aiello's got does not look like it's made out of metal.
No, it doesn't. It very much looks like plastic or rubber.
Yeah, but yeah, I just thought it was a nice little touch that when because you see him struggling to reload the Uzi, and he's got like it could be oil. I think it's paint
Yeah, I
or
think it's
his
paint.
hand. It's like, yeah, we don't need to reshoot that. We don't need to wait for the paint to dry. Just give it to him.
Yeah, I have the feeling that given the hiring of James Glickenhouse as well, who'd made films like The Exterminator, Warner Brothers were being very kind of cheap in terms of making this film, which must have been a big come down for Jackie as well, because at the time he was making big budget films like Project A, Wheels and Meals, and now he's got to work on a much lower budget.
Yeah, but hey, that final stunt is very good.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's where all the money went.
Yeah, I'd say. But so at the end, Jackie and Danny, Ko's dead now. Laura's presumably back in Hong Kong. No, back in New York. And Jackie and Danny get medals from their superior as they look out onto, I think it's the Hudson Bay, as one of the worst songs, end credit songs plays. It sounds like the guy who was singing it, they got him off the street and he made up the song on the spot.
Yeah, it's not a great ending, is it? It's like, I don't know what they, I mean, it probably would have been better if they just ended it after the explosion, to be honest. I don't really know what, there's that moment with their boss where it's sort of like, see, I told you so. And that's all that
Yeah.
really happened.
Yeah, it feels very much like, oh, we've got to have the film end in New York because otherwise, I don't know, Western audiences would be weirded out by the film ending in Hong Kong.
Yeah, or maybe they wanted to. Okay, I think maybe it's more to do with the fact that they wanted one last scene with showing Jackie Chan and Danny Aiello like together. Because if you ended on the explosion, they're both geographically quite far apart,
Yeah,
aren't they? Maybe
yeah.
wanted to give them one last little interaction before the end credits. But yeah, it's a very much a cursory final scene. It doesn't really add anything.
So that brings us to the end of The Protector. Nick, what were your overall views on the film?
Not great. I think it's sort of like a testament to how well Jackie Chan sort of not reinvented but created this persona that we have of him now, that like he clearly did this film and recognized what wasn't working and that it wasn't a good fit for this, and went off and sort of came back with a more fully realized version of his that persona, and a more and a very sort of identifiable way of filming his own films that he sort of stuck with since then. You know, I feel like he d this this film, he's clearly not very comfortable in the role, in the sort of with the swear words, with the
Oh
swearing.
yeah. There's all sorts of, there's like the moment where he's getting on the speedboat at the beginning of the film where he's like, "Give me the fucking keys," and it's
Yeah,
like,
he's not.
oh, so awkward.
It's like square pegging a round hole. But like, I think it's just it's t it, th this film is like makes you appreciate all his other his sort of approach to filmmaking a lot more. If you watch one of his films next, one of his films that he's got a bit more creative control over next to this one, it's like night and day. And it's like not even just in terms of the necessarily the quality of the film. It's just the way it's made, the way it's all. The way the fight scenes are sort of shot and executed and choreographed, it's like, yeah. So yeah, it's an interesting film to watch. It's interesting to watch him, his second attempt to break into the US market and as in, and you know, unsuccessfully.
Yeah, I mean, but it's
But
interesting seeing like the moments of Jackie pushing through in this film where you can see him where he's kind of having some control, but again he's being reined in by Glickenhaus and expectations, Western expectations. So
yeah.
you can see the potentials there, but it's very much being sort of repressed.
Yeah, it's there, it's peeking through, and you can see in like we said, there's the couple of the moments in the massage parlor and the Hong Kong edit of the final scene. I think you can tell that's the Jackie Chan that we know and love. but yeah, the
But it's
rest of it.
interesting. But it's interesting though when you look at like the Rush Hour films and the Shanghai Noon films. A lot of his films from when he made it big in Hollywood from the late 90s onwards, you could see the beginnings of these ideas in The Protector, in the way he's got a Western partner who's completely diametrically opposed to him. And in some of the way in some of the action setups, but in those films, they're fully realized,
Yes.
and you can see in those films, looking at The Protector, you can see where he learned his lessons
It's all
from how it was mishandled in The Protector and applied what he learned to those later films.
yeah, exactly. I think that's fair. I think he looks at this and goes, well, there's a potential for a good scene here. There's a potential for me to put my own print on this. So I'm going to do that in like Rush Hour 2 and the massage parlor scene in there. And yeah,
Because as it is, I mean, looking at this film, it's a weird combination of, on the one hand, very much standard 80s Hollywood action, like particularly the opening stuff in New York with the machine gun action and the ultra violence, and the angry cop yelling at Jackie. But then there's that mixture with all the with some stuff that really hadn't been seen before in Western cinema, like not just the quality of the fight scenes, but also stuff like the acrobatic stuff where Jackie's leaping from boat to boat, or that whole bit with the crates on top of the girder, which again would have seemed totally alien to audiences in 1985. So I guess you can kind of see why Warner Brothers would have struggled to work out how to market this film, or why they would have struggled to work out how to release it.
Yeah, it's not really, it's a difficult film to, I can imagine it's a difficult film to sell at the time anyway. Nowadays you just say, oh, it's a buddy movie and you get people going lining up for that. But before like that was really a well-known like genre, it had been tricky to get off the ground.
Yeah, because the buddy cop genre even then hadn't really, I mean, you'd had Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte in 48 Hours, but it wasn't really until the success of Lethal Weapon that really got off the ground, because most action heroes, 80s action heroes up until that point, had been lone wolves, really.
Yeah, and with 48 Hours as well, that's the relationship is feels in that feels a lot more. It's just because it's sort of like it's not just a buddy movie, is it? It's like they because they hate each other at the start, and there's
Yeah.
that whole character progression in that, and that's very interesting. Whereas in this, they're friends at the start, they're friends at the end. That's not really the emphasis of the film, is it? It's more about the fighting, and they're just
Yeah, it's something that I think would work better again 15 years later. So it was almost like Jackie was really, and I guess Warner Brothers at the time were almost in a way a bit too ahead of their time. Almost in a way a bit too ahead of the time, but also a bit behind the times in the way they treated Jackie.
Yeah,
If that
maybe.
makes sense, kind of.
Yeah. It kind of makes sense.
So I guess in a way, would you say that the Protector is due a reprisal or a second viewing maybe by general audiences, the second opinion?
I think it's worth watching as a sort of curio, as a sort of like, this is what this is this is what we this is like the first like the what's the word, like unpolished Jackie Chan. Like
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend it as a film. Even like no, not even a second watch.
I
It's
mean,
like,
yeah,
oh God.
I think it's interesting to see though how difficult it was for him to get started in Hollywood, and this is like one of the works in progress.
Yes, and I think if you're a fan of Jackie Chan in general, I think it's worth seeing. I just think as a film, as a piece of entertainment, it's not that great.
Yeah, I would probably agree with you on that. So on that note, Nick, thanks for joining me to talk about Jackie Chan's The Protector. Can you let listeners know where they can follow you?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter, IMD Bartlett, or I'm on Blue Sky with the same handle. And yeah, I'm currently writing a few things. I've been covering the Glasgow Film Festival for Critical Popcorn, and I've been writing up. I've got a review coming out for a few films for the People's Movies and for Film Hounds. So yeah.
So, with the Glasgow Film Festival, is that just based at the Glasgow Film Theatre now?
Oh, I've been getting screeners. I
Ah,
haven't.
right.
That's okay. You've ruined the
Ah, no, I've pulled back the curtain.
illusion.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, though, I get screeners from like film festivals from all the time. But yeah, the last time I went, this was 2017, and I'm usually based in Edinburgh, so I had to get the train over to the
Oh, nice.
Glasgow Film Theatre and see the films there. It's okay, but the bar area is so cramped.
Oh no, yeah, I was a little bit late to it this year, and I've been getting just screeners, but yeah, no, there's been some really good films coming out of it.
Do you have anything else like coming up next in terms of big reviews or?
Big review. Oh, I've just done a review of Black Bag, the new Steven Soderbergh film for People's Movies, and Mickey 17 for Critical Popcorn. Coming up, I'm in the midst of writing A Brief History of a Family for Film Hounds, which is really it's a really good like Chinese drama that I've is really cre is creepy in a very sort of understated way. And Spilt Milk was the last film I saw from the Glasgow Film Festival, which is a really nice sort of not nice, but nice is selling it short. It's like a charming like detective story slash family drama. Yeah, it's really good.
How was it? So how did you find Black Bag?
I loved it. I'm a big Steven Soderbergh
Yeah,
fan,
same.
so I'm really enjoying this stage in his career where he's just doing these sort of genre projects. They're not like, you know, he's not gonna they're not like setting the world on fire, but
No.
like he's just tech they're technically very very good. They're sort of really what punchy economical storytelling, and yeah, I really like Presence, but I think I
Yeah, I
like,
did as well because I just reviewed that and the camera work in that's like next level.
yeah, I think, and that's all him, I think, isn't it? It's the
I think
Steve,
it is, yeah.
he was operating the camera for all of that, and yeah, and have you seen Black Bag yet?
Not yet, no, but that was why I was asking for your
Yeah,
opinion.
I would say, I mean, this is barely new. This isn't new. This isn't anything new. But the trailer is quite misleading.
Ah, right.
The trailer makes it seem A, like it's going to be kind of a two-hander between Michael Fassbender and Cate Blanchett, which it isn't, and B, kind of action-packed, which it isn't. But though both of those things work in the film's favor, I think. It's much more of an ensemble, and Tom Burke is incredible in it, and another actress whose name I can't remember who was in. Was it Industry she was in?
Oh, is that the Amy Winehouse actress?
Yes. Oh, she's. I mean, yeah. I didn't see Back to Black.
It was awful.
Yes, I've heard it was awful. But she's brilliant in this in Black Bag. Her and Tom Burke are the two stand, and Michael Fassbender obviously are the two other standouts. And yeah, and it's a lot more sort of cerebral, like kind of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy vibes more than I don't know, the Bond films. But yeah, no, I enjoyed it a lot. I've
Now,
seen some.
Black Bag's set in London, isn't it?
It's, I think it's a pretty much entirely British cast as well, apart from obviously Cate Blanchett. Yeah, it's very good.
Because the next episode of Films That Time Forgot is based on it is going to be around a film set in London, although this time it's 1985 London that's under threat from alien vampires. It's if you haven't guessed yet, of next episode I'll be covering the 1985 film Life Force.
I was gonna guess Life Force. I actually was, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to interrupt your introduction there. That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's a kind of film you have to build people up for. You can't just say Life Force. You have to say it involves space vampires and a completely naked Matilda May.
Yeah, and a very strange assortment of British actors
Yeah,
making a.
you've got Frank Finlay is one. Frank Finlay, Patrick Stewart, Next Generation.
That's a very interesting film.
Yeah, interesting is one way of putting it. I'm looking forward to that episode. And also in May, you'll be joining me for a film you want to do, Breakdown.
Yes, that's I'll be a lot more I'll be a lot more enthusiastic about that one.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Breakdown and it's a wild ride, let me put it that way.
Love that film.
Yeah, Kurt Russell and yeah, I mean, Kurt Russell is incredibly underused in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think he's I think in the 80s especially he just had he was very he was great and everything he was in. I think Tequila Sunrise, he's brilliant
Yeah.
at that. Breakdown, there's a couple of others I can't, obviously the John Carpenter ones, but like yeah, Breakdown is a great film and it's like one of those ones that people just don't really talk about. But it's like it's also got one of my favorite performances from J.T. Walsh, who is just
Oh
one of
yeah,
my.
I mean he was the 90s character actor, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean it's he never I mean he died like so soon after mate. I'm not sure if he ever saw the end Breakdown. I think it might be dedicated to him, but I'm
I
not sure.
think
But
I know he's in a film after this called The Negotiator, which I'm
yes.
going to cover on the podcast as well.
Oh great, okay. Well yeah, I mean, yeah, that's another. I don't like that as much as Breakdown, but yeah, I think he made us a lot of film. He was a very, very busy actor, so I think there are quite a few films that went in, that are in pre-production when he died.
Yeah.
But yeah, Breakdown, and Red Rock West are my two favorite performances from him. He's great. In
Also A Few Good Men as well.
yes, yeah, he's great. I
Yeah.
mean, everything he's in is great.
Yeah, A Few Good Men, Outbreak.
Outbreak is one of the great, I'm going to turn up for one scene and steal the film performances of all time, where he just turns up and just owns that scene.
Completely. Yeah, I
And
mean, takes it completely from Dustin Hoffman.
yeah, so yeah, he's a great actor, and I think Breakdown is one of the best films, like showing his range as well. He like goes from being like completely amiable and trustworthy to like chilling in on the flip of a coin, and yeah, he's great.
Very much an actor that time forgot, sadly,
Yeah.
much like this podcast, which is available on all good podcast platforms, including SoundCloud, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. However, if you want early access to episodes, subscribe to my Patreon, Thorny Film Reviews. That's Thorny Film Reviews. And until next time, keep watching.